Christopher Dunn has worked at every level of high-tech manufacturing. That includes being a machinist, toolmaker, programmer, operator of high-power industrial lasers, project engineer, laser operations manager. And Chris's Pyramid Odyssey began in 1977 after he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. And his reaction immediately after learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice may have had an original purpose that was a little different from conventional opinion. Discovering the purpose of this machine and documenting this case has taken the better part of 20 years of research, and here he is back on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, how are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Good.
Nice to talk to you again.
It's been so long, we could have built another pyramid by the time you came back. It's good to have you back.
It's good to talk to you, too. Thanks
you know,
for inviting
me. I'm in St. Louis. I'm not too far from where you are right about now.
Well, we're going to have dinner sometime.
Absolutely. I'm here for about three more weeks, and then it's heading back for Los Angeles. And by the way, you've done it again with this book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt.
Thank you.
It's just another home run, Chris, and just great job.
Thank you very much.
For a lot of new listeners who are just joining the program, who are relatively new since you were last on with me more than 3 years ago, let's go back a little bit before we go forward and tell us about the Giza power plant and your theories about that. That'll put a lot of this in perspective, I think, for everyone.
Oh, sure. Well, the Giza power plant actually had its genesis in 1977 when I was reading Peter Tompkins' book, Secret of the Great Pyramid. And essentially, the information brought forward in that book was from a variety of people who questioned whether the Great Pyramid was actually originally a tomb. And they suggested other purposes for it, such as an astronomical observatory, a granary, other features, a geodetic marker, a temple, but different purposes than actually a tomb. When I looked at it, though, and this was my first experience of actually looking at the schematics of the inside of the Great Pyramid, the very, very unusual shafts and chambers and little passageways, that it seemed to me that it really didn't make sense. And so the tomb theory really didn't make sense. So I examined it further and tried to make sense of what I thought was the schematics of a machine. And one of the critical parts of the research of this particular machine that is key to understanding it is its precision. And of course, having worked with precision all my life, and manufacturing precision, I'm finding information about an ancient edifice, a structure that was built thousands of years ago that had the precision of a machine, except on a scale of acres. It really made me sit up and pay attention. And so that I then began to, of course, formulate the idea that perhaps if the ancient Egyptians were to put such a tremendous amount of resources into building this structure, and examining the structure in detail, you see that it's a highly sophisticated assembly of limestone and granite, precisely crafted within thousands of an inch in some cases, that the engineers and the construction people, the craftspeople who cut the stone and put it together, were highly intelligent and were highly skilled. And so a civilization that exists that is so talented and so knowledgeable, would they actually support the building of such a structure when it's only to house a single body? It just didn't make sense. So if it was not a tomb, then what is it? And the thought that I had was, well, obviously the people who built it, they wanted something out of it. And normally our largest structures today that we build are power generating facilities. And I thought, well, maybe it was a power plant. And based on that premise, I began to examine it in greater detail, and over many, many years, talking to different people, physicists, engineers, electronics technicians and engineers, and chemical engineers, I finally formulated the theory, which is in the Giza power plant, that the Great Pyramid actually functioned as a holistic power plant device, drawing energy from the Earth and converting it to electromagnetic energy in the form of microwaves that exited the southern shaft of the King's Chamber.
Was it the shape, Christopher, of the pyramid that gave it that its ability to do that?
I think the shape is very important. It serves to be an acoustical horn or antenna, and in fact, it's a coupled oscillator to the Earth. It's also seismically very stable. That shape is very stable in that any vibration of the structure. If the walls were vertical, they would tend to be less stable than the inclined walls of the of a pyramid. So I think the shape and also whether the actual shape of the Great Pyramid and its unusual angle, which is 51 degrees, 51 minutes, 14 seconds, is actually the angle that you would have in a pyramid shape or structure that would encode the function of pi, which is 3.14159 26.
Amazing.
Whereas the perimeter of the Great Pyramid has the same relationship to its height as the radius has to the circumference of a circle. So that the pi factor is definitely in the Great Pyramid.
Christopher, are you a believer that the pyramids of Giza were constructed 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, maybe even farther back?
I'm inclined to believe that the pyramids and temples in Egypt were built earlier. It's not fundamental or crucial to my work to have them placed in any particular epoch or any century. They could have been constructed 2,000 years ago. The evidence is doesn't change. It just gets older. But the evidence is still the same. And so as far as who built it, I really don't have any strong opinion. What I would say, though, is that because of the genius and the manufacturing capabilities of the builders of the Great Pyramid and also the temples and statues in Egypt, because of their capabilities and the clear evidence that they were using mechanical precise machines, or that they were crafting with mechanical precision and must have had machinery, because their evidence actually proves that, as outlined in Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, that because the machines don't exist, we have to ask the question, well, what happened to them? If they do exist, they haven't been found. And so if they can't be found because they're not on the planet or they have eroded away over time, then the further back we go, the more reasonable it seems that we can say that even very large pieces of equipment that would not be stripped down and used for other purposes by surviving civilization would erode over time.
That's true.
If they're made out of ferrous materials, like we make our machines out of ferrous materials. So there is that part of it, too.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, sir.
If an architect today wanted to design the pyramids, what kind of, not for construction purposes, but for architectural purposes, what would he use today? I assume computers, computer graphics, he'd have his calculators with him. he'd have all these instruments to just, you know, outline and plot how this thing is going to be constructed. In ancient Egypt, and we'll get into the lost technologies and the equipment, but I'm sure they had to have had architectural wonders there who plotted this stuff out, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, yes, they were very capable. And one of the problems that we have, though, and which I try to avoid in writing the Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, is that we can discuss what we have available today. But I think what we have to do is study the artifacts and the results of their work and just determine exactly what are the minimum requirements that they would need. How far back in our history would we need to go to say, okay, at this point in our manufacturing history, we have the capabilities to create these objects. And we had the technology and they had the knowledge of the geometry and precision to be able to create these. Now, you know, if we go back even 40, 50 years, and we go back to the time of the slide rules in every engineer's pockets, the engineers of that day were very capable of designing a pyramid that looks or would look exactly like the Great Pyramid in terms of the number of blocks, the shape of the blocks, the position of the blocks. The only difficulty is when you talk to construction engineers is actually putting the thing together, and right. Then in a reasonable amount of time, because the quotation from a modern quarry expert said that it would take 27 years just to quarry the stone to build the Great Pyramid without even putting it together. And there are some construction engineers that say that it's beyond our capabilities. I would rely on a construction engineer's opinion. But there are a lot of theorists who believe it's entirely possible.
Well, you listen to Zahi Hawass. You had 100,000 people running around pulling these things and chopping away at them, and I just can't see that.
I can't either. The problem with the simplistic viewpoint, the problem with simple solutions is when they go to demonstrate those simple solutions, the efforts are simple and primitive. So in the shadow of the Great Pyramid that has 70-ton blocks of granite, you'll see demonstrations on documentaries where there are guys in these little diapers or whatever they call them, hauling half-ton blocks up to the Giza Plateau, and they say, well, that's the way they did it because, you know, they didn't have the machinery, they didn't have the wheel back then, and that we have some tomb drawings that actually show hundreds of Egyptians pulling on ropes on large statues, so they had to have used those methods. But when you start to look in detail at what is required just to cut the stone with the precision and to be able to do it efficiently, the methods that are described by Egyptologists really do not explain the evidence on the ground. So it really needs a team of experts in different disciplines to fully understand and describe what is necessary to build a Great Pyramid. A lot of people have tried, and you know, a lot of theorists work things out well on paper. And having worked in the real world, I know that whatever you describe on paper does not necessarily transfer into the workplace. So it is a huge problem.
Christopher, can you outline for us the possibilities of who may have constructed these? And I know that's not part of your theory of lost technologies of ancient Egypt, but I'm sure you've probably have wrestled with this yourself. But, you know, I would have thought ancient Egyptians, another civilization, extraterrestrials. I mean, have you, how many are out there possible?
Well, I've considered all of them. I've read pretty much all of them. I think that there is a problem when we try to, a political problem, when we try to strip the credit from the Egyptians and assign it to another culture. And that seems to be rather a chauvinistic stance, where we say, well, the ancient the Egyptians weren't capable of doing this. So it must have been another civilization. And right. They're very, very skittish about people who will try to put the credit to Atlanteans or aliens. And even they don't like, it seems to me, they don't like to, or at least the official Egyptologists in Egypt, don't like to accept the notion that the ancient Egyptians used modern equipment, or that they were a highly advanced civilization.
That's a good point, and I wonder why, because even taking the possibility then, the large possibility that Egyptians constructed these with incredible technology, which we'll get into, why would they kind of want to disassociate themselves from that?
I will say that there are many Egyptians who welcome this kind of credit to their civilization, and certainly at Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, I give the ancient Egyptians credit, and actually I dedicate the book to the Egyptians and their glorious heritage. So it's recognition for what they actually did by describing their work. And putting credit where credit's due, which means that the conventional view on how the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids and temples and statues has to be revised. And I think where the political roadblocks are there is in the educational system and the that they're kind of vested in this the Western view of history, which does not include a highly advanced ancient Egypt. They don't consider the Egyptians more advanced than the Romans or the Greeks. So and the Egyptian Egyptologists are trained in the West. For instance, Dr. Zahi Hawass, he got his degree from the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right.
So he was trained by Western Egyptologists in his
thinking
profession.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And there's a lot of money involved in it too.
Oh, absolutely. And is it conceivable that this technology was not just in Egypt at that time, but might have been all over the planet at that time?
Conceivable, I think it's actual. It's not just conceivable.
See, I kind of tippy-toe, Chris.
Yeah, I know you did. It's not like we have to ask the question because we don't know. We know it's all over the planet. All you have to do is travel to South America and you can see it. A Pumapunku, I mean, that's another incredible site that shows evidence of advanced technology.
Hey, Christopher, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and get into Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt next on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, tell us about the evolution of Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. How did this happen for you?
Well, the evolution of Lost Technologies, really, I would go back to the 1986. I was at the Open Air Museum at Memphis, which is a few miles south of Cairo,
mm-hmm.
And it struck me as odd that as I was looking down the length of the Ramses statue, The left and right nostrils on the statue, on the nose, were identical mirror images to each other. And it's always been my understanding, and certainly true in my case, that no adult has identical nostrils. So this was significant to me at the time, and it stayed with me for quite a while. Now, after the Giza Power, of course, at that time in 1986, I was doing studies of the Great Pyramid. I was more interested in the engineering of the pyramids than I was on statues or temples, and
right.
I really didn't travel south to the temples at Luxor, Dendera, and other places in the southern Egypt, but I stayed around Giza and was studying the Great Pyramid and other pyramids. But the that kind of stayed with me. Then, after the Giza power plant was published, I entered into quite a few discussions about the theory of the Giza power plant and also some of the other information that I brought out in the book, particularly the crafting of hard igneous rock like granite and diorite. And I brought into the book a chapter that was entitled Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. There was discussion, there was debate. Some people disagreed with my conclusions. Other people thought they were interesting and felt that further research needed to be done. But there were some people that actually thought that I'd gone too far with the Giza power plant theory, and that the evidence of advanced machining or craftsmanship in ancient Egypt was more powerful a subject, because the theory really could not be proven false or proven to be correct unless you actually build another pyramid.
Right.
And demonstrate it. So the theory is just that. It's a theory. But the capabilities of the ancient Egyptians to craft hard igneous rock to a high order of precision and geometry, that is something that is factual, and it is very, very strong and powerful evidence. So yes. That really weighed into my decision to write a book about simply the craftsmanship of the ancient Egyptians and the tools that they would have used.
Were you in awe with the craftsmanship?
Oh, George, let me tell you. A visit by an engineer, and I've known many engineers that have traveled to Egypt and gone to and walked around the pyramids. I've taken engineers to Egypt and had discussions with them at the pyramids in the north, at the temples in the south, and further south at the unfinished obelisk. And it's always the engineers that end up with a certain amount of humility and awe about what the ancient Egyptians were able to accomplish. You walk through the temple at Luxor, and you're walking between two giant statues about 45 feet tall, weighing 600 tons, perfectly crafted, and a solid piece of granite, solid pieces of granite. And then over near the on the west bank, you have the Ramses statues, the colossi of Mammon, and they are absolutely huge, about 1,000 tons weight each. And you see the way that they are cut and the order of precision with which they are cut. It is awe-inspiring. I'm always awed by it, as many other people are.
Go ahead. No, I want you to finish.
Well, because I always look at it from the point of view, well, how would I create something today? And really, that is the cornerstone of lost technologies of ancient Egypt, and that is to throw the challenge out to whoever wishes to pick up the challenge, to throw the challenge out that, you know, we as lay people, we're not Egyptologists, I'm not an Egyptologist, have watched so many documentaries by different presenters, with Egyptologists being involved and also other disciplines, that try to teach us how the pyramids were built, and they demonstrate using the most simplest of tools, but they never describe the most difficult aspects of the work, nor do they replicate the most difficult aspects of the work. So it was my intention to present to the reader the evidence that needs to be explained before we can say, okay, I know now how advanced the ancient Egyptians were. And it is stunning when you look at the full scope of the work, and particularly the statues. The statuary is simply amazing. And there is a YouTube video. It's on my website. I think it's on Coast to Coast from
Asia.
Yeah,
yeah.
And essentially, that little video is a little clip. Shows the symmetry of the Ramses bust at Luxor. And to collect those images, I actually traveled to Egypt three times because I needed to get a digital photograph of the highest quality, but one that was dead center to the center line of the head of Ramses, because I wanted to test it for symmetry. In other words, check one side of the face to the other. Again, remembering the time when I was at Memphis and looking down the Ramses statue and noticing the nostrils being identical, I detected that not just the nostrils, the entire nose, the jawline, and the eyes were perfectly symmetrical one side to the other. Now, what does that mean in a manufacturing terms? Well, for precision, to demonstrate something is perfect.
It's perfect.
Perfect,
right?
Yes. You have to have a measurement. You have to be able to measure it with a standard. And in the case of the Ramses statue, the standard by which we measure the accuracy is one side of the face. And so we measure the other side of the face against the opposite. And when we have a condition where both sides of the face are perfectly the same, then we know that we have something that was intentionally crafted with extreme precision. And that's what that little video demonstrated. It also shows that they had a system of measure. They must have had some kind of geometric scheme or protocol that they were using in order to transfer information from the designers to the craftspeople to the theorized machines that were necessary to actually control the tool as it cut the statue. And this geometry is amazing in and of itself, in that it incorporates the 3-4-5 triangle. Though the 3-4-5 triangle was first described by Pythagoras, it was known by the Egyptians, and they encoded it in the Ramses statue.
Well, the knowledge is incredible. Last week, I walked through one of these large hardware stores, and, you know, you see drills, screwdrivers, saws, and all these forms of equipment, all these kinds of things that are used to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And just to marvel at lost technologies of ancient Egypt for a moment, Christopher, what kind of tools did they have? They had to have them.
Oh yeah, well obviously they had them all right. One of the things that I did during my research for the book, I contacted a sculptor because I wanted to get the opinion of a modern sculptor to see, what they thought about the ancient Egyptians' work and what it would take them to actually make it, and whether they could make it with the tools that are known to have been in the ancient Egyptian toolbox, or that we accept were conventionally that were in their toolbox. And so I contacted Mike Leckie, who is a very, very talented sculptor, and you can actually see some of his work at mikeleckie.com. But Mike Leckie returned with a letter to me, and he said that he would have to upgrade all his tools, and he's using, you know, steel carbide chisels, and he'd have to go to diamond, and, you know, and even then he won't be able to do it. He said he doesn't have enough time in his life to actually accomplish that kind of work, because he works in alabaster and marble, and the ancient Egyptians were plowing through granite with comparative ease. So I take a modern sculptor's view, but also I have my own point of view, which is that of a manufacturing engineer and ex-toolmaker and machinist. And, you know, the cutting tools that we use for granite would be diamond tools. They cut very slow. There's also a method that you could use, such as impact machining, but you'd have to use, that's where the tool would peck at it at a very rapid rate, like a ultrasonic kind of machining.
Something like a dentist uses sometimes, too.
Yeah, only on a much larger scale. You're absolutely right. And you know, NASA developed that one drill that they took to Mars to cut into hard rock, and that was an ultrasonic, little ultrasonic drill. But essentially, it just eats into a hard material like it's butter. So something like that we could design and use today. Of course, you know, most Egyptologists would choke on the idea that the ancient Egyptians may have had that kind of technology. And so that's where the idea comes in, that maybe we do have to go further back, and maybe these artifacts were misassigned or, you know, incorrectly assigned to the ancient Egyptians and were created by an earlier culture.
When you think of tools, you then have to think of, because we're thinking beyond hammers and chisels, we're thinking of high sophisticated tools, then you have to think of a power source for the tools.
Exactly.
What could that have been?
Well, you know, the power source for the tools, and this is where the Giza power plant comes in, not necessarily to say that the Giza power plant built itself, because it was the power source for the tools to cut the stone, to cut the power plant. It's like what came first, the chicken or the egg. But because it demonstrates that the ancient Egyptians had a sophisticated knowledge of science and technology, and that they had developed a knowledge of electricity, they used it, and were able to generate it. Of course, you know, there's always the arguments, well, okay, if that's the case, where are the wires? Where are the Black & Decker drills? You know, we don't find any out there in the desert. So, you know, obviously the theory can't be right. But, again, we have to say, if we go far back in time, maybe we look for an extinction event, which would be 10,000 plus years ago. Then we can say over an extended period of time, a lot of the materials that this advanced civilization had developed and were using would have been adopted, machines would have been cannibalized, artifacts would have been put to different purposes just for survival. And then eventually over time, they would have rotted away. You look at an old Chevy in a ravine, an Indiana ravine that's been there for 20 years, and you know in a few hundred years that thing is not going to be up to much. So, everything goes back to the earth eventually.
Fantastic. I mean, and it's almost as if they picked them up, the tools, took them with them somewhere, buried them. Who knows? Who knows?
Well, you know, I kind of hope they did, George, because eventually, if they did bury them and they survived, then maybe eventually somebody would find them.
Yes.
And then, the whole debate would be over. Here they are. But now what the debate is centered on is, if you believe, or anybody that comes forward and says they know how these artifacts were made, then they have to prove it. And if they think that the tools that are in the ancient Egyptian toolbox are capable of doing it, then they're absolutely wrong, because to date they haven't been able to demonstrate that.
Can any of these artifacts have been grinded out by hand at all to the perfection that they are?
In my history, there has been a lot of handwork. I mean, during an apprenticeship that I served in England as a young lad, we were taught the old-fashioned way on how to make things, and a lot of things that we made were by hand, with precision. But associated with making things by hand with precision are the gauges to actually inspect the artifact that we're making and to make sure that we are making it to the drawing, which includes particular tolerances or dimensions within a certain precision or accuracy. So even though things can be made by hand, there also has to be precision instruments to inspect it. Now, drilling a hole in granite, there are holes that we look at in granite in Egypt that you look at it and you say you couldn't do that by hand, because the tooling marks on the granite prove that they were using some kind of a tubular drill that was drilling through the granite at a high rate, high feed rate. Similarly, if you go to Abu Rawash and you look at a granite stone at Abu Rawash, you see that they were cutting these stones with a very, very large diameter saws. And the Abu Rawash stone that I describe in Lost Technologies, and which I actually have an abbreviated version on my website at gizapower.com, under the article section, is called Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt Adaptation, where your listeners can go read that article and look at some of the photographs. This particular stone has a radius cut in it along a particular the length of it or the face of it, but that radius ends in another radius. So what you have is what they call a compound radius, which is created when a circular saw is at an angle to the face of one of the radii, or both of the radii. So the evidence on that stone and measuring the radius, which I was able to do by calculating, you know, by measuring the chord length and the sariga height, or the chord height, the evidence shows that the saw that cut that particular piece was over 37 feet in diameter.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is incredible. Now, I mean, wrapping my mind around that notion, or that idea, was quite lengthy. How did they do it? I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's incredible information.
Let's get into some of these various statues when we come back. Let's talk a little bit about the White Crowns of Upper Egypt, and tell me about your interest in this.
Well, the White Crown of Upper Egypt can be seen on top of ancient Egyptian statues. It's also depicted in Egyptian reliefs and artwork. It's a conical-shaped crown, and it's known as the Hedyet, and it's sometimes combined with another crown called the Deseret, which is the crown of Lower Egypt, and combined they are called the Pshent. They symbolize the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt. Many statues in Egypt can be seen with the crown sitting on top of the head of the pharaoh. And in the Ramses Hall at Luxor, several of these crowns had fallen and were placed in front of the statues that are situated in the hall. And it was in 2004 when I first visited Luxor, and it was at night when the temple was lit up, so it was, you know, quite an impressive sight. And the tour guide, the Egyptologist, was actually describing the reliefs on the walls, and the glint of granite actually caught my eye, And I went over to these unusual granite objects, and they were actually the white crown, or the conical crown of southern Egypt, and or upper Egypt. The interesting thing about these crowns, and that these should be of interest to anyone who has a fascination for lost civilizations, and Egypt in particular, but the granite conical crowns were actually shaped like they were ellipses. My studies of them determined eventually that all these conical crowns that are found on the hundreds of statues were crafted as ellipsoids. That in itself is very, very significant. And as I illustrate in my book, with the photographs that I had taken at Luxor, at Karnak, at the British Museum, these crowns are all shaped like ellipses. And the ellipse or the ellipsoid is actually used, I mean, we use it in manufacturing jet engine parts because the tail cones or the inner hubs for some of the assemblies that we make are actually designed as ellipsoids. Okay. And an ellipsoid is actually a solid. It's not an ellipse, obviously, is a two-dimensional shape, and they can be described on paper with paper and pencil, and there is a mathematical formula for them. But the ancient Egyptians, they were not known to be using ellipses, let alone crafting ellipsoids, which is the solid. It's like you take that ellipse and spin it in a lathe, and you have an ellipsoid. The amazing thing about them was that they're not just it's not just the shape, but the feel of these crowns, because they were on the ground. I could actually run my hands over the surface. And I was very impressed with the feel of the craftsmanship, because there were no dips, no bumps, no pits, or any irregularity in the surface. It was just like running my hands over some artifact or piece that had come out of a modern machine. The surfaces were that smooth and regular. But that was in 2004. I didn't have much time, and of course I was with the group, so I had to move on. And it wasn't until 2006, I signed up for a tour with John Anthony West, actually, and I took some digital camera with me for the express intention of actually taking photographs of these crowns and examining them in my computer. Because I was interested to see if these crowns, or one side of the crown, was equal to the other side. And it was in 2006, I took photographs of the Ramses head, which is outside the Temple of Luxor.
And could you see any kind of like mistakes or markings on them? If somebody was sculpturing these things out, it had a groove line.
That's a very interesting question. At the time, I didn't see anything on the crowns or the Ramses head. The crown was about just about perfect, the smoothness of it and also the geometry of it. When I examined it in my computer, and I describe it in my book, the process that I went through. Going further with my investigation, I did start to detect. I did detect through digital zoom in my computer on some of the Ramses faces certain errors, what I would call mistakes. But I had to be sure of what I was looking at, and so I had to go back with a better camera and with a optical zoom. In order to be able to pull that information out a little clearer. And I went back my first visit in 2006 was in February, And I came back and looked at what I had in my computer, and I went to my boss, the CEO of the company, and I said, Judd, I would like to go back to Egypt. I need to go back to Egypt. And I just used up some of my vacation time, and he wasn't ready for me to go back to Egypt. And he says, well, you just got back from Egypt. Why do you need to go back? You know, and I said, well, rather than explain it to you, I'll bring my laptop in tomorrow and I'll show you why I need to go back. And so Judd is a great guy. I mean, he's a very brilliant man, actually an attorney by profession, but has been the CEO of a manufacturing company for over 20 years. So he knows manufacturing very well, too. And I brought my laptop in the following day, and I showed him the symmetry that I was that was coming out of these photographs with the statues, the faces, and also on the crowns. And the way I demonstrated it was the same way that you'd see in that video clip, where I take the original image, make a copy of it, I flip it horizontally, make a mirror image, and then I make it into a transparency, and then bring it across the original to line up the features of the geometry of the crown or the features of the face to determine what kind of error or difference there is between the two. Well, I went through the whole process with Judd looking over my shoulder, and at the end of about 15, 20 minutes, he looked at me and he says, I see what you mean. You need to go. But I showed him another photograph and I said, well, look, if I zoom in here, it appears that what we have on this are tool marks, and I need to go back and not only to optically zoom in on those features to see if they really are tool marks.
Sure.
But I also need to take better photographs, more symmetrical photographs, because the ones that I had taken were slightly off axis, so not all the features of the face lined up. And also I showed him the stone at Abu Rawash and my analysis of the stone at Abu Rawash, so he was very fascinated with that, and he said, yeah, okay, I see what you mean.
That's the one you were on the same show I was on, the Ancient Aliens of the History Channel, right? You were talking about that.
On the evidence, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I did talk about that. That is what I consider to be a smoking gun. There are several people who have called it the new Rosetta Stone because it speaks volumes of the level of technology of the ancient Egyptians. And so, you know, I got to show Judd that particular artifact. And in 2008, I took Dr. Arlen Andrews, who actually used to work at the White House science office with me, and we went to Luxor, and I showed him the symmetry of the statues, the tool marks, and also the stone at Abu Rawash. We went up onto the Giza Plateau. I showed him several contour blocks and the precision of the artifacts there. So, you know, it's been pretty well witnessed by qualified individuals. Everything that I write about in my book.
Christopher, do you think that the tools that were used for these statues were also used in addition to the bigger types of equipment for the pyramids?
Well, I think the knowledge, I mean, in manufacturing, we manufacture all different kinds of products, and each industry, a manufacturing industry, will have the machines to actually match what they're doing. For instance, the scale of the machine tools in a Boeing aircraft company, at Everett, Washington, would be a lot larger than the scale of the machine tools at Danville Metal Stamping, where I work, because of the scale, the size of the pieces that they are working with. I mean, you know, the fuselage and the wing sections for an aircraft could be hundreds of feet long, whereas the largest machine tool we have would be, you know, like a lathe with a 60-inch swing or something like that. So it depends on what kind of a manufacturing company you are and the size of your products. So if you transfer that to ancient Egypt, and you see a variety of different products, such as the statues in the south and the pyramids in the north, and you see the evidence of machine tools. At Abu Rawash, we see evidence of circular saws of 37 feet in diameter, and that's huge. I mean, that's larger than anybody has detected before. William Flinders Petrie wrote in his book, Pyramids and Temples of Giza, in 1883, that the ancient Egyptians were using circular saws. But he didn't really describe any saws of that particular magnitude. But, you know, when you consider it, and you look at the scale of the work, the immense size and scope of the work of the project of building just one pyramid, let alone the nine pyramids that you find on the Giza Plateau. But when you look at the scope of the work and you see and the logistics of delivering a very, very precise stone to the site on time, you know, very quickly, in order to build a structure that is aligned within 3 minutes of a degree of true north, and the outer casing stones were fitted within 0.001 of an inch, and also had an angle on all four sides that were within 2 minutes of a degree of each other. That is an incredible achievement and required sophisticated tooling, in my opinion, to do it. And we have the evidence now at Abu Rawash that shows that they were doing it in a very efficient way. As I say in my book, you know, to the ancient Egyptians, obviously, when you look at their works, size really mattered. And it mattered not only to their structures, but also to the tools. And to think that brilliant engineers like the ancient Egyptians, who were able to conceive of and build the Great Pyramid and the temples and statues, couldn't improve their tools over a 3,000-year period. That is the biggest mystery to me, is that we have accepted for so long that the ancient Egyptian civilization lasted that long without improving their tools at all.
That's,
I mean,
true.
They started off using copper chisels, stone balls, and wooden hammers, and about 3,000 years later, they're using the same stuff. That doesn't make sense.
No. Tell me a bit about the obelisks that you've looked at. They're all over Egypt, and tell me about the machinery for that.
The obelisks are fascinating. I mean, just the the standing obelisk that you see at Luxor, the temple at Karnak. There are two obelisks there, and there's one now standing at Luxor. There's others around the world and in Egypt. But the obelisks themselves are single pieces of granite. The heaviest ones that we know of were actually hauled up, or the finished ones were hauled up by the Romans. And those weighed about 550 tons. There is one obelisk that they were working on at Aswan that never left the quarry, and it's estimated to, when finished, it would have weighed about 1,200 tons. So actually examining the finished obelisks and also the unfinished obelisks, you have the full range of disciplines or techniques or technology that is involved in quarrying, cutting, finishing, and precisely carving deep, beautiful three-dimensional reliefs in the surface of the obelisk, which you find on the ones at Karnak and Luxor. But starting at the Aswan quarry, where they were quarried, you see this trench. There is a trench cut around the shape of the obelisk, and the trench is about 13 feet deep, and there are shafts drilled into the bedrock even further. And the implications are that the marks on the side of the block and also the raw bedrock, it appears as though they were using a tool that plunged into the bedrock and then was retrieved, and then to clear out material, then plunged down again. Because what you see are vertical striations along the surface of the granite, and also intermittently horizontal striations. And this is really the hallmark of machining. And I actually show in my book a sample of something being cut in a modern milling machine. Not any differently than it would be on a daily basis, but simply with a tool plunging down, being retrieved, and then plunging down again, and you come up with the same marks, or vertical striations and horizontal striations, similar to on the unfinished obelisk. So it's been a huge debate for a long time, was how the ancient Egyptians cut their obelisk. And I've been involved in that debate, and I've published on my opinion on it, because using constraint analysis, it's not possible to cut one of those obelisks using the conventional Egyptologist theory, such as using a stone ball with hundreds of workers just chipping away, bang, 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 on 10 hours a day.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And when the time that they were supposedly quarried was 7 months, and it would take years using, you know, with one worker at a working a particular patch and removing X amount of material over a certain period of time, there's not enough time in 7 months to actually perform the work. So it seems like it's a theory that doesn't really hold up. And I address that in chapter 9 of my book. I have an entire chapter on the unfinished obelisk, and also looking at some of the finished obelisks and the beautiful craft work that we see in them.
Christopher, when we come back, I want to ask you basically the $64,000 question, that if high technology, lost technology, constructed all these, what is that meaning? What does that mean to us today? What did that mean then? Christopher Dunn, our special guest, his website, thegizapower.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And also get up to our website and take a look at the YouTube feature video he sent us, and we've got that all linked up too. Christopher, let's accept your theories as fact, that the ancient Egyptians possessed incredible lost technology. What does that mean to us? Tell me the significance of all of this.
Well, I think there's a tremendous significance to our awareness in terms of our cultural filters. When we look at the past and we examine how we have looked at other cultures and some of the chauvinism that has been kind of practiced by explorers or invaders of other nations. If we look at the ancient Egyptians and we see, wait a minute, you know, there are other cultures that can develop a tremendous high level of technology, and we in the West are not the first to actually do that. Now, the other thing is that for me is a quite humbling and a powerful realization, is that the civilizations really are immortal. We're not immortal, and civilizations can rise and fall. And that what has happened in the past can happen again. And so it's kind of like it's a humbling realization when you think, you know, it could all end just like it did for the ancient Egyptians or Kemetians. And so I think that realization is more on a personal level. On a community level, you know, or for what we can learn, there may be technologies or techniques that we can actually develop by studying the ancient Egyptians' methods closely, or trying to determine what they were. Because I don't think even some of the technologies that we have today, we're not sure that they're capable of actually replicating what the ancient Egyptians did. So there's something to be learned there, I believe.
Well, we know in ancient texts in India, for example, as they talk about vimanas, flying machines and things, I have a feeling this planet had incredible technology. And then when you tie in people like Michael Cremo, who, by the way, wrote a little clip for you on the back cover of your
book,
you know, where he says civilizations were sophisticated and millions of years older than we think. I have a sneaky suspicion that this planet, for some reason, might have had civilizations 10, 20 million years ago, and they're just gone now.
But we don't know. And, you know, the thing is there have been some wonderful avant-garde, very brave researchers like Michael Cremo, like Stephen Mailer, Robert Schock, and others, Graham Hancock, Robert Bavall, who have looked at the ancient artifacts with a different eye, if you will, and they see something a little different than what the conventional history books tell us. And they've been criticized very soundly for it, myself included. I mean, the most new age, they become a pejorative term, I think, with archaeologists and Egyptologists, that new age researchers or revisionist historians are pretty much dismissed. And as you mentioned, Michael Cremo, who has been a pioneer in these studies, wrote a wonderful endorsement for my book, and so did Robert Schock, and so did Stephen Mailer and Robert Bavall, and several others have been very, very kind. J.J. Hertak is another one. John
sure.
DeSalvo. I mean, you've had them all on your program.
Oh, yes.
But this book actually supports their work. That is not in competition with any of their views. I mean, they all have a different spin on it, and that is great. We need to actually examine all ideas, not dismiss them out of hand, but to actually say, well, you know, that's interesting. Let's examine that. And the Lost Technologies actually puts information in their hand that they can say, well, here's the evidence. I mean, we have looked for really powerful evidence for a lost civilization, or a civilization that was more advanced, or, you know, a history that we, even our intuition tells us that we don't know the full story, and out of place artifacts and unusual artifacts give us rise the suspicion that the story that is in the history books is patently wrong, and the Lost Technologies actually gives a fairly mainstream account of manufacturing capabilities, and it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that we have not been taught the truth about how these artifacts were created. So there is another story to be told.
And that's another question, Christopher, because there's a reason we haven't been told this. Let's make an assumption they know this already. They know that there was lost technology. Why don't they just come out and say, mankind was here a long time ago. There were catastrophes that obliterated them and the planet. And, you know, but that's just the way it was. Are they afraid that they're going to lose control of us? Are they afraid that, you know, we may all think, oh, my God, it's going to happen to us again? Why don't they just come clean?
Well, I'm not sure that they know what we're talking about. I think that they have heard it. I don't think that they believe that the ancient Egyptians were more advanced. They know that they were very advanced, but they accept the story that's been handed down over 100 years, that they were fairly primitive with their tools. But with the primitive tools, they did marvelous things. So I'm not so sure that there is a grand conspiracy to suppress the information, and I would hope that they would pick up the Lost Technologies, read it, and accept the challenge to come up with better evidence to support their theories. Because after all, they are in the position, they are receiving their salaries from their universities and, you know, those who fund their chairs and fund their research in Egypt. But they're the ones who are doing this for a living. For me, it's just a hobby. So what I would hope is that they accept the challenge and explain to folks like myself how these objects were made. For instance, my company, any manufacturing company, if a customer comes to us with a product, a physical product, and puts it in our hands and says, I want you to make something exactly like this.
Make this for us.
What we would have to do is we would have to determine exactly what it is and describe it in great detail, take measurements, know what the material was, have an understanding of its function, and then determine what processes we need, what tools we need, machines we needed to actually make it.
And then you quote them a price, right?
And then we quote them a price. So that exercise, which is really the scientific method when you consider it, that you describe an experiment, you collect data, you describe the data, you describe your experiment on actually replicating it, and then you do it, and then you compare the results with the original. And that is not done by Egyptologists. They will take a stone chisel and they'll chisel some limestone and say, hey, because I can chisel this little relief in limestone, then that's the way the Egyptians built their marvelous civilization. But they don't describe the work accurately, and then they don't go back and compare their work with the original. Because if they did, you would see that it doesn't match.
Well, that's true, too. How will we find out, beyond your work, is there anybody else doing this kind of work?
There are some very vigorous researchers looking at the same kind of information that I'm looking at. I'm not aware of any published works out there of the same nature. I know that there is a tremendous interest in this kind of research all over the world. I mean, there is a Russian website devoted to this kind of research where they look at the tool marks. They're looking at the holes drilled in diorite and granite at Giza, at Abu Sir, Abu Ruwash. And they also are looking at, you know, the finish on the finish in geometry of some of the stone, the granite that you find at Giza and elsewhere in Egypt. So there is a tremendous interest in this kind of study. And almost universally, they are rejecting the conventional view of using primitive tools to create these artifacts. They know that something else was going on back then.
Christopher, I know what I want to talk to you about, too. I almost forgot to talk to you about you did some work at Dendera, or you've looked into that some of these things look like light bulbs?
Well, actually, you know, I introduced that in the Giza power plant, which was in the crypts at the Temple of Dendera. And that's a very interesting story because in 2006, when I went with Jed, we went to Denver, and I went specifically to spend some time in the crypts for examining those reliefs that looked like light bulbs. In fact, I think Eric von Daniken had an electrical engineer recreate one after the design of the reliefs on the mm-hmm. on the crypt walls, and it worked. I described them as a crutch tube in the Giza power plant. They have the same shape, but it's a cathode ray tube. When I went there, I went on a Sunday afternoon, and it was just a brief visit with the afternoon convoy. And we met a wonderful temple guard called Muhammad, and he was just a real gentleman. And he had the sweetest spirit, the kindest eyes that you ever looked in. And he saw that I was very interested in doing a study there. And so he said, well, if you want to come back and spend more time, come with the morning convoy and then leave with the afternoon convoy. So in that way, you're able to spend about 6 hours. Come on Tuesday, because that's when I will be here and I'll take care of you. And so we came back on the Tuesday. I brought my camera and tripod and other equipment, I spent about an hour and a half in the crypts photographing every relief on the walls. But then I went into the hypostyle hall, and I had noted in the images that I'd taken on the Sunday when I was looking at them in the computer, mm-hmm. that the hypostyle hall in Denver seemed to have an extraordinary precise kind of finish. If you kind of look through, it's heavily damaged. It's been ravaged by time and vandalism. But the hypostyle hall actually caught my attention and distracted me from the crypts, because I spent an hour and a half in the crypts, but I spent 4.5 hours in the hypostyle hall taking photographs. And what I was examining was the columns and the alignment of the columns. And the amazing thing about these columns in the hypostyle hall at Denver is that each one of them has the face of Hathor described on all four sides. And the face of Hathor, the Egyptian goddess, Hathor, by the way, was the goddess of love, drunkenness, sex, but she was also the goddess of destruction. So it's kind of like a Saturday night, Sunday morning kind of affair with Hathor, I think. But her face had been ravaged, and every image on the columns, the capitals on the columns had been destroyed, so that the face was obliterated. But there were features still on these capitals that were remarkably precise looking. And so I took some close-up photographs. I also took some photographs from a distance. The columns are about 50 feet high. The ceiling's about 60 feet tall. The capitals are about between 50 and 60 feet tall. They're about 7 feet in diameter, the columns. So they're extremely large. There's 24 of them in the hypostyle hall, and I was able to take photographs of sections of the columns where I would have four columns in a photograph or six columns in a photograph. But my camera was pointing directly up and square to the architrave above, and what I found out in my graphics program, when I was examining the columns, that there were features of the columns that were perfectly in alignment from one capital to the next. And these were actually three points in three-dimensional space where you have three surfaces coming together, two flat surfaces and a radial surface that actually meets on one side of Hathor's cowl or headdress. And there's two of those points on each capital, or each side of capital, and the alignment between those points from one side to the other was spot on. It was perfect. But not just on the one column. You go over to another column, and it lined up with those two. All the features were in alignment. The corniche, there are two corniches on the, on these capitals. Those are in perfect alignment, and there are other features like the cowl or the tresses that come down and end at the top of the column are crafted to end, they're shaped as an ellipse. So here at Dendera, you have another ellipse in the capitals of the Dendera Hypostyle Hall. They're absolutely amazing, and I actually showed shown these photographs to architects, and I gave a presentation in Paris in March of this year at the Giza for Humanity conference, and there was an architect in the audience, and he actually wrote an endorsement for my book. His name was Alain Hubrecht, and he's from Belgium. So it was the alignments, and even having those alignments so precise after thousands of years is mind-boggling. But just the work involved, you know, the conventional theory of how these temples were constructed was that they would pile up these blocks, drag them up a mud ramp, and then pile them up and then start from the top and start chiseling their way down and come up with the perfection that we see today. But the evidence there is, as I write in Lost Technologies, there is evidence, and there's a photograph, there are detailed photographs in the book, some color plates, some not, but the detailed photographs show that they would have crafted all the elements that go into crafting the columns and the capitals above before they actually assembled them. And it's quite the Dendera Temple is an amazing place to be. It's a magical place to be.
Well, Matt, yeah, I'm telling you, you've done magical work here, Christopher, with Lost Technologies. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, final hour with Christopher Dunn. You can talk to him about this work, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, and also the Giza Power Plant. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, before we take calls, tell me a little bit. Did you use a lot of computer software in order to do what you did to, you know, look at the statues and things like that?
Yeah, the program that I worked in was Canvas for Windows, which is a very capable graphics program that allows you to manipulate images and also allows you to define geometry using any kind of lines and shapes. It's a very, very capable program. So and it's easy to use too, but the program is not the most sophisticated graphics program. There are other programs out there that are more sophisticated with three-dimensional geometry, but I did not have three-dimensional images, so the canvas for Windows was quite adequate for the level of detail that I needed.
Isn't it amazing that we need sophisticated software to determine whether the ancients used and had high technology for what they did? It's really ironic, isn't it?
Well, I'm really happy that you pointed that out, because that is a very, very significant point to make, is that the more sophisticated we become, the more sophisticated we see the ancient Egyptians, because we didn't really have the tools to take these kind of to collect this kind of data years ago. Moreover, even though we've had it for quite a while, we don't look for this kind of We don't do this kind of analysis. For instance, three-dimensional images are being taken of a broken statue near the West Bank. The reason why they're taking three-dimensional images is so that they can bring them into a graphics program and reassemble them. They number the pieces, and then they reassemble the pieces in the CAD software, the 3D CAD software, before they physically put them together. So there's no mistakes, no errors. They can just go select the pieces, and they know exactly where they go. So that is one use of them. But the other use of using the kind of technology such as three-dimensional imaging with laser scanners or even a system like Capture 3D, which is white light imaging using targets on the subject, you can collect the three-dimensional images from the artifact, say the Ramses statue, and bring it into your 3D program and compare one side of the head to the other to determine to within what tolerance are they precise. I mean, we know that the ancient Egyptian, when we asked the question, well, were they aware of such precision? Why would they use precision? Yeah, the evidence for a high level of precision can be found in the Serapeum, in these huge granite boxes that are finished to a very, very high order of precision. That really, when I measured them or compared them to a straight edge that was within 2/10,000ths of an inch, there was no discernible variation of the accuracy of this ancient artifact and the straight edge that I was using. So we know that, I mean, they definitely were using precision, and precision in places where it really didn't belong, such as on the Giza Plateau, on architectural elements. Why did they find it necessary to cut something to within, say, 1/1000ths of an inch, when it was going to be far away from, or elevated to a height where away from any kind of close examination, it just wasn't necessary. So it does kind of speak of a machine technology that where they were cutting these artifacts the most efficient way they knew how, the fastest way they knew how, but the machines were highly calibrated and they were capable of nothing less than what they, as far as accuracy and precision, they were capable of nothing less than what we find on the artifacts laying on the ground in Egypt.
What do you think happened to them, Christopher? Have you come up with your own theories on just what happened? Where did it go?
Well, there are two things that we could discuss. Well, one is that they were there after a cataclysm and they eroded over time. The other question is, or answer may be that, you know, just like today, we will go onto a site and take our tools with us, and then when the job's done, we take the tools away because, you know, they're not necessary anymore. Not necessary there, or they're needed on another job somewhere. But where they were taken, if they were taken away, and whether they still exist in that place, I don't know. It's a huge mystery. But people say, well, where is the evidence of machine tools in ancient Egypt? Well, the evidence is laying all over the place because you can't explain their creation any other way. You can't, and it hasn't been, I mean, people have tried to demonstrate that they can be made, that these artifacts can be made using simple stone chisels, but they always fall short. Such as like trying to demonstrate that you can build a pyramid using manpower and copper chisels and stone axes, it doesn't work. They have to resort to modern methods.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Russ, first of all, first-time caller, Clarkston, Washington. Hey, Russ, go ahead. You're on with Christopher Dunn.
Greetings, George and Christopher.
Greetings.
Hi, Russ.
I've been calling for months trying to let you know about this because I've been listening and I haven't heard any mention of it at all, and that's the cracking of Ed Leeds Skolnick's Coral Castle Code.
Uh-huh.
Jeremy Stride cracked this several years ago, and I came across it, and I've been studying it for weeks. It also ties in with the subject matter. In fact, the only point in his cracking of the code that I haven't been able to prove to myself is what I'd like to propose to your guest. A right angle that connects with the base, the center of the base of the Pyramid of Giza at a 45-degree angle, splitting the apothems, supposedly is supposed to come out to the factor of phi.
Do you understand this?
If that's true, then there should be something in those pyramids on each face at the factor of phi, the short end from the base up. There should be something in there. Has there been any kind of a sonic resonance study of the pyramid to see if there's any chambers in there at all?
Well, the Great Pyramid, yes.
We know there are chambers, don't we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. I know there's chambers and all kinds of corridors and whatnot. And I've checked those, too. They don't go to the factor of phi or the 45-degree or 90-degree angle at a 45-degree angle.
Well, Russ, to actually address your... The subject matter of Coral Castle and the, is it Jeremy Stride who cracked the code?
Yeah.
I was directed to his website and I looked through it. I found it very interesting, especially the connection with Masonic symbols and Masonic temples. What I've always said, though, is, and this is my position, obviously, is that for somebody to say this is the way a person did this work, then they have to use those methods to replicate the process and actually reproduce it. So if the code leads us to be able to move the large coral blocks that are at Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida, the way Lee Skolnick did them single-handedly, 28-ton blocks, 30-ton block, you know, a 22-ton obelisk. He did a remarkable work over the period of time that he was working on it and moved almost 1,100 tons of coral single-handedly. It's an amazing achievement. If somebody can replicate that or be able to do that and say, this is the way Lee Skolnick did it, then I think... he would get a lot of attention because I definitely believe that when Lee Skolnick said and that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built, he put his money where his mouth is and he demonstrated it. Unfortunately, he took that secret to the grave. Supposedly, he left some clues behind, and this is what people like Mr. Stride are picking up on, and myself. I think that his little booklet is called A Buck in Every Home, which actually is a treatise on how to raise a young lady. If that's a metaphor, it may be. Who knows? But it's a very unusual little book. But I think maybe there is some code in that book where he described the way he constructed his castle and lifted very large blocks of coral.
Okay.
I'd like to see Jeremy actually do the work, and then I would say definitely the code has been cracked.
There's something there. Elyria, Ohio. Hey, Mike, go ahead. You're up with us.
Good evening, George and Chris.
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Chris, I love your perspective, sir.
Thank you.
If you could give me just a moment, George, I could run two things quickly, just on the theme of a pre-Egyptian civilization. We know that the cartouche above the King's Chamber's granite beams is ink-stained and not an etched hieroglyph. and I believe could be carbon dated, since it puts forward as evidence that Khufu and his kingdom's dynasties period proves when that pyramid was supposedly built. And, Chris, there are no hieroglyphs in the Great Pyramid, and at Karnak, there are hieroglyphs on everything, even at the top of pillars that aren't normally visible by people. The Osirian at Abydos, with the 100-ton pink granite pillars, are not adorned with hieroglyphs. And I just wondered if you had looked at this Osirian, and could it be linked to the Great Pyramid as evidence of a pre- or older Egyptian civilization?
Well, the cartouche that is in the upper so-called relieving chambers, which I don't believe that they're relieving chambers because they only hold up their own weight, but the cartouches are actually on the gabled limestone blocks that that actually bear the weight on top of the king's chamber. And it has been suggested that the Supreme Council of Antiquity carbon date the paint, but they refused to do it. For what reason, I don't know. But sometimes information can cause you to go back to the drawing board and revise your theories and opinions. So the paint that is they daubed on the limestone block to make this cartouche with the name Khufu in it has not been carbon dated. If it ever will, I don't know. As far as the Osirian, I've been there. And there are no. You're absolutely right. It is. You come out of the Abydos temple, and up a rise, and then look down into this kind of. It's almost like a swimming pool with these massive granite pillars, and overhanging unusual blocks, different shapes. Multi-ton, hundreds of tons, and when you look at it and you think, this is absolutely, this definitely looks like the Valley Temple near Giza, near the Great Pyramid, but it doesn't look like a temple per se. It looks more like a building, a structure, maybe for support, maybe it was constructed at an earlier time, but had a different purpose than you know, just being a decorated temple where people gather. It's my impression that it wasn't built for people to gather there. So,
okay, thank you. Let's go to Kyle in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Kyle, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say what a privilege it is to listen to your show every night. And
well, thank you, Kyle. Very kind of you.
And it's an honor to speak with both of you gentlemen tonight.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
No problem. I was just wondering, I believe it was in the show that, George, you were on, Ancient Aliens,
mm-hmm.
that they had, like, some kind of proof of, like, almost like a TV or, like, a projection system in some tombs. I was just wondering if Chris had ever heard of that or seen that, maybe.
Okay.
No, I haven't heard of that. I the only electrical device that
they had a picture. I think it was a hieroglyph picture, Chris. That looked like they were large projection tubes. And the,
yeah,
they, you know,
was that the one at the Dendera Temple?
That's the
light bulb or crux
yep.
tube. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that has been interpreted as actually a symbolic symbol, as a flower, or it symbolizes the universe and life in the universe. But the it definitely has the appearance of being something electrical, because you have what the device that is holding up the bulb, it looks like an insulator, but what you would actually see on our power lines today. So it's certainly it's not unusual that some people look at it and say that it's a technological device. Unfortunately, we can't convince Egyptologists that it is, because technology such as we're talking about here didn't exist in ancient Egypt, according to their theories. So,
what's your favorite smoking gun with your research, Christopher?
Well, my favorite, I have to say that my favorite is the Ramses statues, because not just the precision and the symmetry, but also the existence of tool marks, such as the one statue at Karnak, where you have the tool marks evident on the side of the face, and that was very exciting to discover and actually capture in my viewfinder, because they resembled the same kind of tool path, if you will, the direction that a tool will take on a modern machine tool that would be cutting the shape of a face or a head. And I show an example of that also. So in my book, you have plates showing this statue with the tool marks on it, and also a CAD program, a 3D model of the tool path that we would use on a machine tool.
Christopher, when we come back, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, before we take final calls, what's your next project? You've got Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. What else is out there for you?
Well, that's a good question, George. I think that's probably, if I was to write another book, I will probably direct my attention elsewhere. And I am actually heading to Peru and Bolivia with David Childress in January.
Tell David hi for us, by the way.
I will do that. And, you know, if any of your listeners want to come along, they can contact David at westclub.com, or there is a link on my activities page on my website. But it's just a small tour that we're doing. I was down there in 2005. And we went to Machu Picchu, Ollantaytambo, Sacsayhuaman. Then finally over to Bolivia to Tiahuanaco and Pumapunku. But there is definitely something going on there, and it's going to make for a very interesting research. And who knows? Maybe another buck will come out of it. But there is some fascinating artifacts. And very, very capable engineers in South America, too.
Super. Let's go to Andy in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Andy, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good.
Chris, my question for you was just your personal, if you have an opinion, on different world ages, like how the Hopi believe that we are in, like, I believe it's the fourth age of man. And that perhaps maybe through the ending of an age into the beginning of a new age, that some of these old tricks of the trades to build these things that make us go, you know, wow, how to do it, pass on through. Because some of this ancient technology is kind of, I mean, it's really marvelous. And my second question is, what do you think about, if you've ever heard of an old Irish rant about how they're claiming, the Irish are claiming personal responsibility for the pyramids? So they say it's a poor in place. It's as simple as that. And if they're looking for alcohol, of course, they'd rule the world.
Okay, well, your first question on ages, I think that obviously if we look into history, ages have come and new ages have taken place, where generally associated with a different mindset or different patterns of thought, such as in philosophy and science. In the last few hundred years, it has been associated with invention. So you have the Iron Age, you know, the Industrial Revolution, or the Scientific Age, obviously, and the Industrial Revolution that has changed the way people live and changed the way people think. And back to George's question earlier of me, as far as what can we learn by recognizing ancient civilizations existed, and it is to actually kind of bring it or create, or if you will, encourage a different way of thinking in terms of different cultures in the world, but also to be able to recognize technologies that may have existed in the past and try and reinvent them in the present. Now, on the as far as the Irish claiming that they built the pyramids, I think I heard a buzz about that, but I don't think it's getting much traction. Now, you know, my ancestry is Irish. My grandparents were from Ireland, and I'm from Manchester, England. So,
so you're gonna don't take credit for this now, Chris.
I'm not taking credit for it. You know, if they want to, if somebody who kissed the Blarney Stone would like to take credit for it, I don't know. But I kind of avoid that kind of discussion in terms of taking. You know, the Egyptians have been pretty much raped and pillaged over the years. You know, Egypt has had controlling powers, and they've been stripped of their artifacts. Some say that, well, they didn't know the value of them at the time, but that's like the Indians didn't know the value of Manhattan, you know, and sold them off for some beads. But the Egyptians are very sensitive now that not just their physical artifacts are being taken away, but their heritage is being stripped away, and credit is being given to other cultures. I think that I don't support that at all.
Okay, we now have Eric driving to Portland. How about that, Eric? We have a GPS on you.
All righty. How are you guys doing on this magical evening?
All is well. Thank you.
Very, very good. God bless you, George. You're doing us proud. I'll get real quick to what I want to say, just to be fair for the other people calling in. I find it very, very odd that the Egyptians were detailed, and we have pictures of the religious ceremonies, the burial ceremonies, the way the cultures were, even pictures of UFOs, etc. But nowhere do you find any pictures of them building, and do you find any tools. And that's kind of odd. It's like that little bit was erased or withheld. And is that something that you think was done on purpose, or it was just meant for them at that time to understand? And if a certain time ever were to come into the future again, i.e. the awakening that's going on Earth with the Indigo Children, etc., and the energy and the vibration, do you think we weren't supposed to know, and that's why there are no pictures of all of that, and when we do need it, it'll be there again?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, and I could float a speculation, and really based on post-traumatic stress. Imagine if your civilization was suddenly destroyed and your iPod no longer worked, and it's sitting on the table there, and it's never going to work because the power plants have shut down. And it's just a reminder of how great life was at one time, and basically you just take it away and destroy it because you don't want to be reminded of it. I don't know. I mean, you know, what does happen after a catastrophe that destroys a civilization? Some of the things will survive. What happens to them then? Now, as far as a different mindset, yeah, I think it's coming in terms of social awareness, and you know, these kind of studies have certainly affected me. And I think anybody who, you know, who travels to Egypt and sees the evidence on the ground, and gets a sense of what that culture may have looked at, you know, what we're looking at now is just the skeleton of a very highly advanced civilization. And because there are no writings, I mean, you can go to downtown and look at works of art, or look at, you know, the municipal sculptures in around Chicago and other places, and I don't know any places where you see depicted machine tools, or, you know, people actually working on machines or describing them in any great detail.
Good point. Okay, let's go next to Frank in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Great to talk to you, Chris and George.
Super.
My question is the obelisks. The obelisks in three different countries. And one is in Rome, one is in London, and one is in Washington, D.C. And these all have their own government. They all aren't under the control of the country they're in. Is there any significance, and what is the detail of the significance?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understand. The obelisks that are in London, Rome, and in New York all came from Egypt. As far as the one in Rome, it's at the Vatican, so it's controlled by the Vatican. The one in New York is in, I believe, Central Park. So as far as them being controlled by a foreign power, I don't know who has custody of them, really. Is there a board of trustees? Certainly the Catholic Church would have control of the one at the Vatican and ownership, but perhaps you could flesh out a little bit more your question on that.
Well, the Vatican has its own government. It has its own police. It has its
right.
own
banking system, everything.
Yeah, and same with London and same with Washington, D.C. It has its own centralized, just in that area where the obelisks are, like...
Oh, they're in the financial centers or the centers of power, obviously. The money that went into, or the resources that funded bringing the obelisks probably came from those particular locations. That's where they were installed, in New York, London, Lisbon, Rome. But the Vatican obelisk, it wasn't originally at the Vatican. It was brought by the Romans much earlier. But it was moved to the Vatican by Pope Sixtus.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Frank. One more. Frank? Oh, Frank's gone. Okay. Let's go to Ryan in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Go ahead, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call, George. I'm really excited about the show. It's excellent tonight. And I just have one quick question for Christopher. Along all your journeys in Egypt, have you ever encountered any supernatural experiences or anything like that? That's pretty much all I had to ask.
All right. Thank you. Anything supernatural? Unusual like that, Christopher?
Well, yeah, from the time I stepped off the plane till coming back. Egypt is really an amazing place. And so I think the first thing you have to recognize when you travel there is that, you know, it's a different culture altogether. They're wonderful people. But they're absolutely incredibly friendly and accommodating. And it's such a good time. The city of Cairo never sleeps, and so and Luxor is a magical place with the temples. And normally it is a holiday atmosphere, particularly when you go with a group of people, because you're on vacation and it's a magical time. As far as supernatural, I know of people who have had some experiences that are unusual. And what those experiences were related to, I really believe that there are technologies still active in Egypt, and those are acoustic technologies, in that the pyramids are in tune or in harmony with the vibrations of the planet. The civilization was, or at least the structures on the civilization, were placed in and designed in a way that was in harmony with the country, and also, I mean, there is some Robert Babal's work that ties in the structures with the star systems. I think it's significant, particularly when you go back into ancient China, and you see that it was an art or a procedure of placing buildings according to certain stars so that they're more feng shui and in harmony with the cosmos. And you know, these kind of beliefs don't seem to fit within the Western mind of, you know, hard science, the Cartesian view, but I think there's definitely something to them, and I think there's definitely something still active in Egypt, and I know a lot of people that I've been to Egypt with that will agree with me.
Okay, let's go to Randy in Philadelphia. We've got you. Go ahead, Randy.
George.
Hi.
Peace be upon you and your guests. Is it Mr. Christopher Dunn?
Yes,
yes.
Sir.
Okay. A couple quick questions. Any of your material on, say, like CD or anything like that?
There are some DVDs out.
Okay.
Where I am presenting.
Okay.
At conferences. I think you would find some of those at David Hatchett Childress Adventures Unlimited.
You don't have books on tape yet, do you, Christopher?
I don't have any books on tape, but I do believe that the publisher is going to have the Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt on Kindle eventually, or an e-book, whether it's the Kindle or the Nook or other other formats. But as far as talking books, I don't have any yet.
Not yet.
Okay, that's good. One more quick question.
Sure.
I hear you talk a lot about the blocks and the size and, you know, physicality and this and that, and how heavy they were and blah, blah, blah. And every material I've seen, not just you, this is not personal you, that I've seen or heard of or read of about the pyramids and those structures there, about the physicality of them. But we hear, I guess maybe they can't comment too much on it, about the sheer mathematics and intelligence that went up there. Is that sort of mathematics beyond where we are?
Well,
academically,
we know one thing, that the size, they're so big, Christopher, we don't have equipment today to be able to lift them up and move it. Thank you so much. A classic Coast to Coast show with Christopher Dunn, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.